session three in writing as shelter, growth, and fruitfulness of mind. This is the session on whose words are they? And I'm Nancy Barry. Hi, everybody. How are you?
Hi.
Good to see you all today. New room. We have to get kind of gather in here. Hey, Mary. Hey, Nancy. How are you? Come on in. These two people who just came in, Mary Nielsen and Nancy Jones, are former colleagues of mine of various stages in my writing life and teaching career. And they've both read my work, they've both edited my work, they've both taught me how to teach, so I'm going to call on you especially to do some work here. You don't go sitting back there in the corner and acting like you don't have to talk.
I'm here to be fed.
How about you, Nancy? Are you here at work?
Yeah, I'm here until 11:30.
Oh. Well, welcome. Welcome to you all, whether it's your first day in the sequence or the third day. I'll try and review quickly of where we've been and what we've been doing, and then we'll get to today's topic, which is entitled, Whose Words Are They? I think where we were the last 2 days, we've drawn on two great writing books of the last 30 years. Peter Elbow's Writing Without Teachers, Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg. I noticed in the bookstore on one of the other bookshelves that's sort of behind the bookshelves where it says Teachers Staff Recommends, under the arts and crafts section, they do have Julia Cameron's book, The Artist's Way. So that book is also available in the bookstore. And then the one that I should have recommended to put on the list that I mentioned the other day is Annie Lamott's book, Bird by Bird. Wonderful, wonderful writing book. All-purpose. These are all-purpose writing books. Okay, so where are we? Well, we spent 2 days sort of talking about the complexity of what it is to get started on a writing project. Pre-writing sort of makes it sound like you're not going to write, and someone like Elbow would say, in fact, you do need to start writing right away. But this is all the stuff we talked about the last 2 days. Free writing, timed intervals of non-stop writing, where you force your pen to keep moving on the page, 10-minute junket for yourself, 15-minute junket. Once again, just kind of review Natalie Goldberg's admonition. Keep your hand moving, don't cross out. Don't worry about spelling, punctuation, or grammar. Lose control. Don't think, don't get logical, go for the jugular. Right? So if you're really going to get started on a project, you want to kind of just like one of the streams that I saw yesterday on my hike. I mean, it's got to be strong, it's got to be forceful, and your body should feel the energy kind of moving from head to hand to page. And it can be done on a typewriter word combo. We're talking about this, Gordon. If you use a word processor, sometimes it's really interesting to turn down the screen so that you literally cannot see what you're composing on the screen, to force yourself from getting hung up about whether you spelled a word incorrectly, or because, you know, that's the wraparound features of word processors. It's very disorienting. I have to say, I've done it a couple times, and it's really, I mean, you're there typing and you have no idea what words are appearing. But it is a great way if you're inclined to always stop and edit and go back and respell or cross out or change a word. It's a great way of not allowing yourself to do it. We talked the other day about reading. Casual reading, the whole gamut, spectrum from casual reading to focused, intense reading. Collecting means just kind of working in an observational mode for any material at all. It's like when I've got a writing project in my mind, there's a file drawer in my mind. And anything at all that kind of comes in, just crosses my scene of vision, goes through my mind, something someone says, I just kind of make a note either on paper or sometimes just enough so that it's there in my mind. Read this book on, go see the newspaper, maybe watch a film on. Just kind of a collecting reservoir, it's like a pot that you're making soup in, and you know you're not gonna really get to the soup for quite a while, but you want to put things in it. Talking. Never underestimate the power of oral language to help you move further on a writing project. Now it's true, all of these, and then outlines. And we talked a lot on Tuesday about outlines, and I kind of wanted to find some advice on these, and so I went back to Elbow, and we talked through what their liabilities are, what their problems are, when they're too much focused, when they're too much sort of grounded in a meaning that you know of, they have a tendency to be restrictive. if they help you open up the project, then they can be useful at a stage, at the early stages. So here's what Elbow says about it. I used to think outlines were made of single words and phrases, but I found that's not good enough. I found the only effective outline to be a list of full assertions, one for each paragraph. Now this is when he's talking about sort of later in the thing. Each must assert something definite, not just point in a general direction. Then the progression of assertions must make sense and say something and so forth and so on. And then he talks about the essence of outlining is easy come, easy go. You want to use an outline, think of it more as a list, think of it as a broad list, think of it as possibilities rather than restriction. I think that's the key thing. Okay, so you got all this stuff. You've got all this stuff. Is it good stuff? Is it bad stuff? Don't worry about it. It's just stuff. It's material. You're collecting it.
Nancy?
Yeah.
Can I throw in something?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
So those of you here who are doing Enneagram or thinking about personality and so on,
right,
that if you're an extrovert, your tendency is to talk out your stuff.
Oh, yeah.
If you're an introvert, talking can help you refine things.
Right.
But the advice my writing teacher gave me at Iowa was, once you start the writing process, don't talk to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because for an extrovert, I would talk out my ideas and then I would forget them.
Yeah.
They'd be gone and I wouldn't write them.
Yeah.
So different types have to do different things with talking.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I mean, you know, graduate school is nothing but a series of conversations had instead of dissertations written. I mean, that's it, right? I mean, it is. Remember, writing's physical labor. In some ways, it is easier to talk than it is to write. And I think that's why, yeah, in fact, I should have put an asterisk here. I think we all have to be, when are you talking to avoid writing, and when are you talking to really help yourself write? And that's something that everybody's got to kind of pay attention to in their own psyche here. Okay, center of gravity, again, this is sort of Elbow's phrase. I like it because it's three-dimensional. It implies sort of the energy of thing. His words, the turning point in the whole cycle of growing is the emergence of a focus or theme. And the key word there is emergence, and focus there is loose, and theme should be loose. It's also the most mysterious and difficult kind of cognitive event to analyze. It is the moment when what was chaos is now seen as having a center of gravity. There is a shape where a moment ago there is none. And the best analogy I have for this is what the writer John McPhee used once when describing his tour through Hershey, Pennsylvania. Hershey, the place that makes Hershey's chocolate. Anybody ever been there? Did they you go through the thing? I've never been there. I only know it through McPhee's words. And they take you through and they show you the vats and everything. And do they describe the process of how it's sort of decided when it's chocolate?
Well, years ago, you could go past the vats. Now it's more, you know, hygienic. But no, I don't remember the cocoa beans and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, and see, he had an interview in one of his essays. He described the guy whose job it was to decide it was chocolate. I mean, there's this whole process, and there's these vats, and it goes from assembly lines and from the beans and all of that. But all of that operation still relied on one guy, and this is, I'm sure that person is, I mean, I don't know when this date was in this essay, but McPhee was mesmerized by this because I think it was directly analogous to the writing process in so many ways. All of that industry still relied on a man, in this case, dipping his finger into the vat and taking it out and saying yes or no. And come on in. And this is what Elbow's talking about, of the emerging focus. This idea that you just you work with the language and you're sensitive to when it's ready to take on a center of gravity. Or when you're feeling that center of gravity. That's why I love that metaphor, because it really is a sense that your mind is pulling towards some sense of order or structure or chaos. It's not neat order. That's what I mean. It's chaotic order still. But there is a little focus emerging.
Nancy?
Yeah.
I have been reading fiction this week.
Mm-hmm.
And since your first class, I now notice when the author loses his center of gravity.
Oh.
And my mind starts to wander, and I spreadsheet. And see, well, it was here, but it's, you know, it doesn't link up again until page 240.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Well, and that's sort of what we're going to talk about today, which is readers, when they engage in a text, also do this, right? We locate centers of gravity, and we kind of take that energy source and flow with it. Okay, so then you've got center of gravity, and these are some other metaphors of ways of thinking about the writing. Instead of thinking about the writing as moving in a neat sequence of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 steps, or as many people do when they're in educational systems, sort of just conflating the whole thing in 1 or 2 drafts to turn it in when it's due. Instead of thinking about it that way, think about this thing as an organic object, something that's going to grow, something that's going to evolve, something that's going to take on a shape, something that you and your mind and your hand and your creative and aesthetic impulse are cooking. Now, along the way, and early on in the process, I think it's most useful to let readers in. And that's what we're going to talk about. And that's why today's session is called Whose Words Are They? Because as soon as you let readers into this process, the question, the writing leaves you. It leaves your mind, it leaves your hand, it leaves your paper, and it goes in a space that exists between the writer and the reader. Now, let's just brainstorm a little bit about why we like and dislike showing our work to other people. In other words, what are the pleasures and pitfalls of letting readers in to the writing process? We'll do it. Here are the pleasures and here are the pitfalls. Why is it that you do it? What is it that you worry about when you do it? Just real quick.
They won't get it.
What's that?
They don't get it.
Yeah.
Embarrassment.
Right.
Lose control.
Yeah.
You have to put up with their suggestions and then risk losing their friendship if you don't take them.
Friendship. In other words, one of the ways of summarizing this is that there's something personal at stake, right? There's something personal at stake in that.
Intensely personal.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's like taking off your skin, not your clothes.
Oh yeah. So it's really
exposure.
A revelation.
An
exposure. Yeah, and.
On the other hand, when I write theology, it has a personal dimension, but it's a communal discourse, so I really benefit from getting other, it's scary, but I think it's really important, at least for my own work, to get lots of input.
Right.
I have so many blinders on, I can't see my own.
Your ego would be involved in people saying that doesn't seem logical, or this doesn't work flow, or you're mixing your metaphors.
All of these are. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Not that you're a false person because you...
Well, I have that issue too, but I think the benefits are... Now I have both going on, but I just love getting other people's ideas.
Okay, so expanding, there's two things actually, Anne, that I'm hearing you saying. One is that sharing the writing is a communal act.
Right.
That when you do that, you take what was yours and you make it something shared between people, whether it's one reader or a group of readers. So that's one thing, and that's a pleasurable thing. The other point here is that you actually can expand the meaning, that when you let other voices into the thing, right, you can change the shape of the thing that's grown. Yeah, in the back.
I think it's important to think about your audience before you start. Who do you really want to read this? Who are you really trying to communicate to? And obviously, the broader the group, the better the input.
Right. So, and that's true. Readers are an audience. And, the suggestion that you think about audience right here, see, I put an asterisk next to that, too, because there's a way in which physically imagining readers, my father, a congregation, the neighborhood yeah.
Think about like businesses, like who's your target market?
Right. I believe that's true. But there's also a way in which deciding who your audience is can completely negate some of the openness. I mean, I have started to write things that have been very personal. A letter to a friend that over the course of a month or 2 months becomes a much wider essay for a lot of people. And so I think audience is something that flows through our mind, but again, if you think about it too rigidly, too quickly, you can really kind of conflate, you know, or constrict this thing. Other things about this, yeah?
Sometimes it's a good check about what is it you're putting out there, comparison to what you're carrying around in your head.
Yeah.
That maybe you're not expressing enough of it to.
That it actually helps to clarify, right, what it is that you're trying to say. I mean, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think one of the reasons for positive is it's a way of getting affirmation. Yeah. I mean, there's always the hope.
The risk.
The risk will say, gee, that's really good. Yeah. Or I feel the same way.
Yeah, yeah. This connection that affirms and then widens. Yeah.
For those of us who don't intentionally write for readers, it's just a matter of getting it down.
Okay.
I have something here I don't want to forget.
Right, right. But you're not going to let readers into that.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's a positive thing for me.
Okay, right. And that sort of is over there, right? That it's a way for you, whether readers get into it or not.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that tomorrow, about the journal thing a little bit. Yeah, in the back there.
There's a sense of completeness when something written gets read.
Yeah.
That fulfills its purpose.
Yeah. Because, I mean, there are those who, it's interesting coming on the heels of what Gordon said. I feel like this board has a life of its own. That's all right, that's good. Oh, I see, tighten it. Oh, there's a trick. This is like, thank you, Karen.
You got left brain.
I teach it 9 o'clock on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday in the semester. Can you stop by in my class? I'm terrible with any kind of equipment. I mean, anything. This, computers, audiovisual stuff, and you know, you talk about your greatest impulse being your worst sin. I'm terrible with this shit, and I keep trying to use it. It's true. It's really true. I do these lectures for 600 students, and I always have at least 2 videos, 1 piece of music, 5 overheads. Okay.
I just read a comic by Norman Mailer, which I thought was just hilarious, and he was talking about the benefits of old age. And one of the benefits for him as a writer was that he could read his writing that he had done the day before, the next day, and edit it carefully because he had absolutely forgotten he'd ever written it.
And the thing is,
when you're younger and your mind holds things, it takes you at least 6 months to get enough distance on something to be able to read it and edit it.
Yeah. And that's
what a friend can do.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. That's the advantage, is this helps clarify because it's an outer perspective.
Yeah, this should also more prolific.
Yeah, right?
You know, you just sit down and you crank it out.
When you're younger, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. You have more energy, right? Less distraction.
To push it to another extreme. Does it work?
I want to come back to something. I got distracted by the board there. These 2 comments about Gordon's, and what's your name in the back?
Friend.
That's an important thing to realize at some point in this process. Am I writing for me, or am I writing to get it out there? And I think one of the reasons that the process of readership often gets real kind of screwy sometimes, particularly in that personal sense, is because writers haven't really thought very much about that. And there's an impulse in us to write toward meaning for ourselves. But there also is a sense that, well, I've written it. Writing, the joy of writing is it communicates something to another person. that's it, you know, that's why books are a pleasure. So this is a complicated thing. Anything else? Yeah, one more comment on our grid here.
One thing that I was going to say, I write poetry, and, you know, I think it comes out, it's almost like giving birth. It's a real birthing kind of a thing. And yeah. Then, well, do I share? And who am I writing this for?
Right, right.
Because it comes from...
That metaphor of this process, analogous to the birthing process, is one that many, many writers and poets have talked about. It's one of the sort of time-honored, we call it a conceit, an extended metaphor.
Oh, it's joy when it's done. It's like, look what I've done, you know.
Right, and because and this is the thing, this is the paradox of writing. It comes from our innermost self. But if it's going to reach readers, it has got to take on a form and a body and a life and a language that is less connected to ourselves and more connected to readers. That's one of the fundamental paradoxes of writing, is that it is from the innermost self, but by the time the thing really goes through stages, and time is one of the crucial things intellectually that we fail to give writing projects. Now, of course, I'm a writer who takes years to complete things, you know. This is why I've not made a career in journalism, because I just can't just do it at the speed at which some pieces of writing require. But this notion that the thing takes on a structure and a shape and a body and a set of lungs and a voice that will enable it to live in the world, and it's not completely ours. At that point, we have shaped it for readers. Yeah, there and then there and then the back.
There's also really a difference between if you're reading it to others than if they're reading it.
Yeah. Why? What's the basis of that difference?
I think, for instance, sometimes you end up putting expression and body language into it that's not there. Because I was really very pleased with something that I wrote, and I got such accolades for it. And then I read it about 3 months later, and I thought, what were they reacting to? Because I realized that part of the message they had gotten was from my voice inflections and my gestures that I was making while I was reading it.
Yeah. Okay, and that's a question I'll talk about in sort of the actual construction of a writing group workshop, whether you read aloud or read it on the page. Mary, and then...
Well, I was going to pick up on the metaphor of birth, and that when you finally move into the publishing end of things, it's very much like sending your 3-year-old child to boarding school and not seeing them for, you know, 6 years. And what comes back to you is a very different thing, and it may in fact be exactly the vision of the matured product that you want, if it happens that the boarding school has all your values and all your insights. But very often what editors and copy editors and design people and publishers and stuff do is it isn't your image for your baby.
Yeah.
And the book comes back and you get the first copy in the mail and you just want to cry.
Yeah.
It's not you anymore.
Right. And I think that's something else here in this scheme, that it's true. When we let readers in and we sort of take the writing and we kind of put it out in the center, it is less ours. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that when it actually goes to publication, mm-hmm. right, because the stakes get higher and higher and more people get involved, it becomes particularly less ours.
Yeah,
in the back.
When you're discussing the editing process, kind of, you know, ultimately you have to determine your audience, and you even mentioned journalism. It made me think of a couple things. I am a technical writer, mm-hmm. and I'm making a transition now to doing some personal things, ultimately for a broader audience. But when I was in art school, they teach you to draw first. You gotta know how to draw. You gotta know how to technically draw before you can get into abstract expression. Like Picasso was an amazing artist. He could mm-hmm. draw perfectly, fully, you know, realistically. So could Dali. But you know, look at the end product. So I guess what I look at it that way, same thing with writing, you have to be able to do it. You have to be able to edit, you know, you have to be able to technically do it properly first, it seems to me. And then you can move on.
Well, Elbow would quarrel a little bit with where you're putting the... I guess I would too a little bit. I'm not arguing, because, and this is a complaint about this sort of approach to it. Yeah, it just produces a lot of junk. You just get a lot of junk. And that belies the fact that there is this other part of the process, which is rigorous, technical. Every handbook should be open to whatever page it needs to be. Every rule about commas and spelling, every possible intellectual machine-like node in your brain about order. There is a point in which that has to come into the process. But the assumption here is that if that stuff comes in too soon, we will never say all we might say.
Well, maybe
that we have
it
to.
Comes back to your comment about the editing process. Maybe someone who's more technically trained than whatever journalist is going to provide a product to that editor.
Yeah.
It's going to come back more in its original form.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
I think that's why so much of teaching that exists as editorial work is so flawed. Because really, editorial work is a hugely collaborative thing. It's writers develop relationships with editors, and that's how they work through all of that kind of mind-bending precision. But the point is, don't edit until you know that it's going to stay in your text. I mean, why spell check a word if it's just one of 100 words that are going to be reduced to 10? Well, that's just a waste of energy, really.
Well, it becomes a way of thinking, doesn't it? Ultimately, I mean, at least it did with me. I mean, I remember the way I used to write reports compared to how I write reports now. I just think more efficiently. I start out with something that's a lot closer to a final than I did.
I agree with that. People who have developed a writing repertoire can go through the stages probably quicker. But I still believe that we don't spend enough time often in the generative process. Yeah, Mary, then we'll move on.
Two quotes that I want to throw out that I use in my classes. I teach at the Summer Writing Festival, and both the classes I often teach are highly technical. And how to write sentences, the algorithm, how to write sentences, what to do with metaphor, blah, blah, blah. And two quotes that I use. One is a quote I heard about Michelle Kwan when she won the World Championship. I don't know if any of you saw that program. It was absolutely the most gorgeous skating thing I have ever seen.
Oh, she's a skater, right? I was thinking gymnast, but she's a skater.
Yeah, skater. Absolutely gorgeous. And the newscaster said, now that she has the technique down, the artistry can come through. Now that she has the technique down, the artistry can come through. Okay. Then Flannery O'Connor, who said, learn everything that you can about writing and then forget it.
And then forget it, right.
Because when you sit down to write, you cannot have that crap in your mind.
Yeah, yeah. What I was saying the other day about this is that the process of writing, like the process of growth, taps into different features of our intellect and our cognitive and creative process. And the trick is for you as a writer is to figure out which lens you need at what point of the process. Okay, so what happens when you let readers in? Well, it's dangerous, it's messy, it seems at first to add to the chaos. What are its rewards? That you're actually taking something that is yours and offering it to a wider circle, that the thing will get better, that is to say, more of what you want or are hopeful that the project might become, and that there's this thing of affirmation. For you as a person, and that, you know, language that is shared turns out to be more than the sum of its words. Let me say that again. Language that is shared creates a meaning that is more than simply the linear recitation of words on the page. And I think Holden Village is just an amazing place to study this. Because things are said out loud in community, it changes what that community knows and comes to believe and trust and understand. So that's why it's worth it. Okay, well, how do you do it in such a way so that you don't feel powerless and you don't feel quite so vulnerable? Well, you set up, either with one person or with a group of people, a kind of teacherless writing class or a writing group. And I'm going to use a story to describe how writing groups should work. This is an analogy. I have a sister and in-law, my brother. They have three children. At one point, the kids are still in age ratio to one another, but when they were younger, it was more dramatic because the oldest was six and the youngest was about 1.5 or two. And I would go to dinner with them, and when I visited, share many meals. And I was astounded because there were these three children, all under the age of six, and food was not an issue. If there were no food fights, there were no screaming about food. They had their meal, that was it, and it just wasn't an issue. So I was astounded by this, and I said, Betsy, how did that happen? I mean, really, it's kind of peaceable, you know. They come in, they ask for something to eat. You say, well, here's an apple. If they say they want it, they take it. If they don't, that's it. How did that happen? She said, I was so lucky. She said, I heard this pediatrician on the radio once, and she said, I just made a commitment to it because it made so sense. He was talking about food and children. And he said, here's how it can go in a family about food. He said, there's two jobs about food when you raise children. And, you know, this is all quote, right? I don't have children, so I'm not an authority on this. He said, there's two jobs about food, and we all know it's more complicated than this. He said, it's the parent's job to determine when healthy food will be served and made available to children. That's the parent's job. They have to decide on meals, they have to create the meal times, and they have to get the food and make it available. That's the parent's job. It's the child's job, once they're past infant stage and they need to be fed, it's the child's job to decide whether or not to put that food in his or her mouth. And food dynamics in families get all screwed up when those jobs get reversed. And children start making decisions about when food is going to be available and what food is going to be available. And parents start actually trying to control putting the food in children's mouths. And as I said, it is more complicated than this, I know. But for me, this is the secret of a writing group, right? And the writing process. Writers decide what words go on the page. That's the writer's job. You get to decide that. They're your words. You decide what words go on the page, you decide what words stay on the page. That's your decision. Readers have their job in a writing group is to give, Elbow's phrase here, the movie of the mind. It's the reader's job to say what happened in their head and in their body when they read those words on the page. And writing groups get all screwed up when those jobs get reversed. And readers start saying to writers, change that word, take that word off, shorten it here, begin there, end it here. And writers start trying to control and tell readers what happened inside their head when they read that stuff. It was supposed to be funny. This is a joke. I'm writing a joke. If no one laughs when they hear the joke, all the explanation in the world is not going to make it funny, right? So in this give and take between the writer who's created all this stuff and the reader who's going to come in and start to, you know, enter into the process, it's important to remember that the most significant thing that readers can give to writers is an account of what happened intellectually, emotionally, and physically when they read those words on the page. Because that is the information that is completely unavailable to the writer. That's what the writer does not know and cannot know. Right? It's the writer knows all that went into the generating, all that was said, all that was not said, all that was. But the reader is the one who can say, when I read this, here's what I thought, here's what happened, here's where I got confused, here's where I came alive, here's where I fell asleep, here's where I wanted to know more. Okay? So think about that in a writing group. Think about that. Yeah, Anne?
That's just great. That's going to make my life easier if I keep that in mind for grading. And my job is not to tell the student necessarily what words they should be putting on the page, but to engage with what happened when I read it.
Absolutely.
And that takes the burden off of you of saying, well, you should have put this verb there and transferred that, you know. A whole different kind of interaction. It's wonderful.
And if you think about, well, I said this on Monday, Bobo's kind of grid here about why does it happen that people who are 6 and 5 and 4 love to write, little children write eagerly and with great pleasure and abandonment, and will write for hours and read it out loud or give it to people to read. They love it and find it easy. Why is it by the time people have finished high school, if not college, if not both, that they feel they cannot write, that they have anxiety about it, why does that happen? It happens because, I really do believe this, as teachers, and I fault myself for this, you know, still to this day, because it's quicker, it is easier. We come in and we simply layer over on top of the page. Wrong verb, what word, awk, that's the favorite.
Yeah.
Awk, A-W-K, short for awkward. You know, and oftentimes, I mean, it's really kind of sad, oftentimes teachers do it with a shorthand that is absolutely mystifying to most writers. They don't know what the hell it means. And so to get out of that, just step out of that mode and say to writers, even when you're teaching them to master the craft, you say, I'm going to give you a movie of my mind as I read your paper. It's my job to show you where and at what moments I actively, and this is a physical thing, I actively found myself kind of engaged with the words on the page. I felt one word out of a sentence rise up and just kind of have stars around it. Where I got confused, right? Where I got confused. So that's what we're talking about here. So your job as readers in the writing group is to give a movie of the mind as you read. It's not, hold on to what you're going to say, sir. It's not, unfortunately, because we all want it, to applaud or condemn. When I do a writing workshop at the college, I tell students, the language I do not want to hear is, I like, I really liked. Now, it enters into it, and again, this is a paradox thing. It is a gift. Writing is a gift. I think the first thing you say to somebody who gives you a piece of writing is, after you read it, you say thank you. Because it is a gift, and it is a risk. And, you know, it is. It comes from that part of us that is childlike. You know, we draw a picture, we pick something up out of the ground, we turn to another person, and we say, look what I found, look what I did, what do you think? You know, why have you been married to me for 40 years? I mean, you just want the other person to say, yeah, thank you. I got it. And I think that sense has to happen when writers share with readers, because if it doesn't, they won't go back to those readers. But I think the problem is that oftentimes in writing groups, we get hung up on that. And we take what should be an initial receptivity and support and thank you, and we don't do this whole other intellectual cognitive process of really looking at our heads and you know, okay, it is a gift and I want to treat it as an expression of the self, but let me tell you what happened as I read it so that you can figure out what you want to do with it if you want to do more with it. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
It's just one point of clarification, make sure I understand what you're saying. When you say movies of the mind, what you're saying, at least now, to me, is more, it's more conceptual than nuts and bolts. Is that what you're saying? Deliver the conceptual criticism or praise rather than nuts and bolts versus awkward sentences, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I think it's entering into the piece of writing. It's entering into the piece of writing.
Let the writer deal with the nuts and bolts, more or less, when you give it back to them, but keep them in the conceptual stage in terms of your criticism or praise.
Yeah, and not, and see, this is what I've refined from, I mean, I think that's a fair summary of what I said, but I want to clarify something. I think criticism and praise is ineffective or inefficient, non-productive ways of looking at other people's writing. Because as soon as we get into this criticism or praise, you're in this hierarchy of what's good or what's bad, which is non-material. For every reader who finds a piece of writing they are drawn to, there is a reader who will not be drawn to it. Like and dislike is really immaterial in the writing business because there's too many kinds of writing and there's too many kinds of readers. And even good and bad, we have to be very meticulous about what standard of good we're talking about. Good in a newspaper is completely different than good in a theological essay. right? Good in a sermon is completely different than good in a family history. And that's the other reason that writing groups get all screwed up, is that people start applying these standards of what's good and not good willy-nilly based on, you know, this repertoire of whatever classes or things they've read or novels they've liked. And that becomes the standard by which we judge. Oh, I like this. This is good. It doesn't mean squat, really. What matters is, what the writer is desperate to know is, what happened? What happened as you read it? Right? And here's some language for that, and then we'll try and kind of enact this a little bit. Here's some language here. Pointing, right? So here's one last general thing, and then I'll get to this specific. Your mode as a reader, when you're trying to help a writer, is to be descriptive rather than evaluative. Descriptive rather than evaluative. We spend a lot of time on this in my writing classes, and it's amazing to me how long it takes for us to get it down. When you, what I try and say to students first, when you look at a piece of writing, describe what's there. Describe what's there in language that all readers of the piece can agree with. And they say, well, what does that mean? Well, it means, for example, if we take this book as an example, if I were to make descriptive comments rather than evaluative ones, I would say a descriptive comment is, this book is 191 pages with an appendix of 3. I say, well, who needs to know that? Well, I can't. Let's be a little more specific. In this chapter 4, called The Teacherless Writing Classroom, I notice that the first person I, doesn't appear until paragraph 6. In this essay about what you remember from your grandmother's kitchen, I notice the word blue is repeated 4 times. In this memoir that you're writing about your summer vacation, I notice that you spend a lot of time talking about getting there, but when you finally get to the cabin, you've only written 1 paragraph, and the whole piece is 4 pages long. These are descriptive comments that simply help the writer to see what is there. What is there? Because all writers write stuff all the time that they don't know what's there, especially when it's really a lot of free writing. So one of the things that I try and really practice with people in writing groups is describe what's there. Instead of using this language of I really liked, or I didn't like, or I wasn't sure, try to begin your sentences with I notice. I notice. As I read this piece, here's what I see. And make sure that you're aware whether you're seeing something that all readers of the piece would see. There are 6 paragraphs in this, right? The first person doesn't appear until. Or whether you're seeing things that in fact are implied judgments, right? Whether what you're describing is it has with it a judgment. Because, you know, the line between the observation and evaluation is a pretty thin one, right? We notice, in fact, the things that we are drawn to. But I think intellectually, even as academics, we spend a lot less time paraphrasing and describing. We don't do that enough. We jump to evaluation. We jump to critique. We jump to argument. And part of the thesis behind Elbow's epistemology here is that our intellectually, especially in creative enterprises like writing, we would serve people better if we noticed, observed, paid attention to, he uses the word, believed, rather than critiqued, evaluated, edited, and doubted. Okay? All right. So here's some things to do. Here's some things to do. And then we'll get in small groups and finish up the morning with this. Okay, another decision. Sorry, I keep this is you've seen the best and the worst of me as a teacher. And another thing. Not only am I not good with equipment, I'm not good with time. I'm not good with time. You have to decide whether you're ready for readers. You really have to decide. And this is back to the food analogy. You're the writer. That's your decision. That's your decision. Right? Somebody says, oh, I really want to read your diary. Sure they do. If they think they're in it, sure they do. So that doesn't matter. I see a draft, I gotta see this. So that compresses the whole thing. You know, the reality of writing in the real world where there are time constraints means that the truth is we move through this process probably a lot more quickly than we'd like, but the good news is we get more written than we might. Even so, you have to know as the writer that you're ready to kind of turn it over to a reader. And the other thing that I say to writers is, it's up to you. You've got to tell the reader where you are. How can the reader know that this is free writing that's gone through just like two spurts of free writing or three spurts of free writing that's not even ready to be edited yet? How can the reader know that? Right? If you want to start a writing group, you got to get everybody on the same page of what it is you're going to do when you look at writing. And so one of the tricks, I really believe, is to have the writer say, here's where it is in the process. It's, use the cooking method. It's very raw. It's not even defrosted. It's very raw. Well, this piece is, I've been working on it for a week or for a couple of days. I'm still a little worried about X, Y, and Z. And so you say where you are and what you need, right? Because otherwise, there might be someone in the group who, because of years and years of seeing their work edited, right, kind of just jumps in initially and says, well, you know, I think that's not a sentence. There's a fragment there. I mean, this is an extreme example, but isn't that a fragment? Aren't you supposed to write in complete sentences? I always learned that you're supposed to write in complete sentences. And you're back here. I mean, you haven't even decided what's in the soup yet, and somebody's telling you whether or not you got to worry about a complete sentence. So, but you got to shape that as the writer. You're the one who's got to say, okay, here's where it is. Here's kind of what I need. And by need there, I don't mean approval, affirmation, it's the best thing you've ever read in your life. I mean, try to help me find the center of gravity, try and help me find whether or not there's a focus, try and help me find if there's a shape or a pattern that you can sort of feel in here. You gotta decide that. Okay, so what do you do then when you're acting as the reader? Well, one of the things you do when you give a movie of the mind is you simply point. The words or phrases that most penetrated your skull. That's what Elbow says, penetrate your skull. I that seems to me to be kind of an invasive metaphor. But again, I sort of say to writers, point to those places where the hair on the back of your neck stood up. Point to those places where you literally felt kind of something in your brain go, oh. Tell the writer where those places are. That's what the writer needs to know. Where the thing picked up energy in the mind of a reader. Okay? So the best thing you can do for someone in a writing group is to point to the places where that happened. Okay? And this is where, I'm sorry, what's your name, the woman who talked about reading out loud?
Meredith.
When Meredith talks about the difference between reading it out loud versus reading it on the page, you also, as a writer, need to make a decision about that, because you, as a reader aloud, you can force that in certain places. That's what your narrative, to me, described. Whereas if you let it exist on the page and you give it to people on paper, you're really just asking to kind of see whether or not the words on the page did that. Okay. Places that seem to have a lot of energy, that somehow rang true. Places, another thing is, listen when you read a piece of writing where something in you went, oh yeah. Listen when you read a piece of writing for places where you went, huh? What? I didn't get it. Well, keep reading. Okay? So that's one thing. Point. Summarize. Tell very quickly what you sort of saw as the center of gravity. And here's the thing though, this is another thing about this. Okay, so the readers are sort of doing their work. They're pointing, they're summarizing. This is where the writer has to sit back. This is where the writer has to be an owl. Right? Once you sort of say, here's where it is, here's what I need, then you gotta stop trying to control the food chain. And you let readers tell you the movie of their mind, and you don't interrupt them, and you don't try and tell them when you think they got it wrong. Right? That's another way in which writing groups get all screwed up, is that the readers start talking about, well, you know, I was with this because I thought blah, blah, blah. And then I got, you know, it was a story about your vacation, and then I got confused because you started talking about your uncle, Nick. And then the writer comes in, and the writer says, oh, well, I had to tell about Uncle Nick, because Uncle Nick, you know, is important to the story, as he was my father's brother, and unless you know about Uncle Nick. See, no. See, right away, then, you've messed up that food chain. The writer sits back and just listens and collects movies of the mind. Just collect them. And they will be contradictory. They will be chaotic. They will, especially if it's a group that you can kind of come to trust and work with over a period of time, they will locate themselves on centers of gravity and centers of response. And then you do what owls do, which is eat everything, swallow it whole, and excrete what you don't need, right? Now, it's true that's, you know, we all kind of, well, how do you know what you don't need, right? I mean, this is in every class I teach, you know, students give responses to one another's writing. And somebody says, well, about the introduction, you know? And there's a reader who says, I didn't get the introduction at all, I thought it was too long, blah, blah, blah. Again, the evaluative stuff comes into it. But if it's phrased, this is the thing, if it's phrased with the assumption that the evaluation, first of all, is premised on a close reading of what's actually there, and also that it's not given as advice, right? That makes a huge difference, right? When you slip into evaluative language, you don't say, well, you know, because I thought the intro was too long, you've got to shorten it. Anyway, so a student says, oh, the intro, you know, I seem to bog down, blah, blah. And the student says, oh, I thought the intro was great, you know, I did. It drew me in, I got really involved right here, I wanted to know. And invariably happens, you know, the student sort of looks at me and says, well, what do I do? It's your writing, you gotta decide. You gotta decide. My answer usually is write it both ways. Write it both ways, and then read it, and then see what you think you want to go with. But it's not, it's this idea that you don't as a writer collect responses and try and do a census of them. You don't do a vote, you know, it's different, you know, how many people want the verb, you know, share in this paragraph? That's not it. You collect, you sift, you cook, and you let it grow. You let it grow, and when you look at the writing again, you use that response as a way of moving it forward in the process with further shape, further development, further refinement. You're creating another version of the text. Okay, pointing, summarizing. And then this one here, this is really where we get into the movie of the mind. Simply tell the writer everything that happened to you as you try to read his or her words carefully. Right? Tell the reader what happened, the movie of your mind. What happened as you read the words? Here's an example of telling from actual classes, just so you can hear some of this language. This is a reader responding. I felt confused about the man in the gray suit and the men gathered around you. This is what they were responding to was a story. I suppose they're cops, and then the escorts, because I had first thought that the gray suit was a cop, but then I thought he was a dignified person who got arrested. I was uncertain about it. And then you talked about the men gathered around at one point, fairly early. I felt like they were cops, and I wanted you to contrast them to the fantasies. There was one point where you talked about, I think you were going down the stairs. I felt like that whole part with the father of the bride and the gown was like a flash that a person has supposedly when he's going to drown and his whole life flows behind him. I thought it was like an initiation of a girl or a woman, particularly. I was surprised. I didn't expect you to describe things that way. I was really happy. Then for some reason I felt like when you talked about the men who were gathered around, I felt like they were cops. And if I heard it again, I might feel that I didn't need to have you say it, but at the time, as you said it, I wanted them to be blue-suited or something contrasting. Perhaps that wouldn't be necessary for some other reader. It's a whole different language. Whole different language than, I really like this. This is a good story. End it sooner, begin it quicker. Change your passive verbs to active verbs. And again, I'm not saying that over the course of writing, we don't often change passive verbs to active verbs. We don't have to create a shape. When the thing is finished, it's got to engage with readers in such a way that they can't put it down. If you really want people to read something, the best way of making sure they'll read it is to work on the prose in such a way, or the poem, that once they get it, they feel the energy and the language move to such a degree that they will not put it down until they get to the end of it. But the way you get that is not through some, here's how you write a good poem, here's how you write a good novel. It's by figuring out through a process of free writing what you have to say, letting readers in and listening to what they have to say as they read the piece. And then, and we'll talk about this maybe a little bit tomorrow, revision that takes on the thing here, think about it as a body, revision that involves the bones, the muscles, and the skin. Right, so I think another way to think about it is, in the whole process, you are moving from right brain to left brain. By the time you really are wanting to shape and get it so that readers really are just compelled to keep reading, you are bringing all that left brain stuff, the editorial skills, the rigorous, most brutal teacher that is in your head saying, why should I read this? I mean, the person who can say, oh, you got 20 words, you only need two. I mean, I do think there's a way in which that's, but you don't need that at the beginning, and you really don't even need that until farther along the process than most of us admit it. And even when they do that, they don't have to be that mean about it. They don't have to be brutal. Robert Francis is a wonderful poet, and he says when he gives people his drafts of poems, he says to the readers, and friends, the editors, he says, be brutal. Well, you know, workshops all around the country, graduate level, and sort of filled with writers who went to the workshop thinking they could write and left the workshop not thinking they could write. And the reason that they came to that conclusion is people were brutal for no reason at all other than that they liked to be brutal. In the sense that they thought this is sort of the intellectual work, you be brutal. And my whole philosophy of writing workshops is that it's a much more humanistic process, that someone has something to say, they want it to reach readers. Readers can help them along the way. And so it's readers' job to help in the cooking process and the growing process. It's the writer's job to do the work. Okay, well, this took a whole hour. How many of you have things that you want to read, that you've got, that you want some response to? Let me just see. Anybody got a piece here that they want to do? Okay, here's what I'm going to suggest. If you have a piece of writing that you've been working on, find someone here that you recognize or know, or come up to me over the next 2 days and say, can we do a movie of the mind session? Mm-hmm. And we'll just sit out under the tree, and you'll read it out loud, or I'll read it, and we'll do the movie of the mind. Or you can ask that of someone else, right, who's in here. You know, if there's people that you know each other, you say, you know, I kind of want to hook up with you, and I want to try this writing response thing. Can you just give me a movie of the mind, and try and just get some practice in that language? Okay? All right. Tomorrow we'll talk about journal writing, which is another version of this sort of personal writing. But when I do that thing tomorrow, it's going to be a little bit about, so you've got all these, there's two parts of the thing tomorrow. One is, so you got a journal, or you've left a journal, why would you want to keep a journal? That's why it's called Yet Again, because journals, lots of people start them and then they abandon them. So part of it's going to be about the range of journals that we can keep and why how they do different things for us as writers. And the other half is going to be what happens when there's something in the journal that you want to move to the public. Okay, so that's going to be about tomorrow. Okay, so take me up on my offer about being a reader or find somebody else. Thank you very much. See you guys later. Thanks for coming on such a beautiful day.